For more information about Ancient Dragon Zen Gate and Tygon's teaching, please visit us at ancientdragon.org.
So, good morning, Bodhisattvas.
Good morning.
So, last week we celebrated Buddha's birthday. And we ritually bathed the baby Buddha statue, pouring sweet water, sweet tea. And during the period of Zazen, prior to that ceremony, I could hear or feel our Zazen smell, our Zazen perfumed by the voices of children in the kitchen. So this was the first time we actually had an event that I think explicitly invited family and children, families and children to participate in our morning program. And it really occurred to me that how our Sangha is finding its way together, and the inclusion of children and families and maybe the entire universe is our practice, and finding our way to do that, I think is really wonderful. And of course, you know, some people are like, the sound of children really interrupts my Zazen, you know. Some people are like, oh, I really like that. So that's our practice, just kind of watching that delusion as it arises and ceases, and finding some middle way. So it got me thinking a little bit about this teaching, great Buddhist teaching of the middle way. And I guess what I'd like us to kind of explore together today is that teaching of the middle way. And I'll say a little bit about it, but also I'd like to encourage you to see how that manifests and arises in your own life experience, both, you know, sitting on your cushion, but also in your daily life. You know, the middle way isn't some map. You know, it's not a Google map. I don't know, I haven't tried to Google the middle way, but I think it might not be there. Although it might. Yes, Google's kind of Buddhist friendly. And, you know, it's not like a linear midpoint. You know, middle is a little deceptive, right? I'm going to be in the middle, so perfectly centered. But even in our sense of being off balance, where we can find, I think, kind of an uprightness to meet whatever's happening. And interestingly, you know, so we had Buddha's birthday, and then Buddha grew up and traveled around India seeking enlightenment and kind of figured it out. And he kind of wandered around for a little while trying to figure out what to do with his teaching, and eventually he gave his first public talk, somewhat reluctantly so. And I don't know if you're familiar, some of you might be familiar with this, the Wheel Sutra, the Dharma Chakra Parvatana Sutra. That's Buddha's first talk, and that's the first place I'm aware of that the middle way was actually mentioned, which I thought was kind of interesting. So I thought maybe I'd just read a little bit from that sutra. So this is after Buddha's, you know, figured out his enlightenment, whatever that was for him. And then he was a little reluctant. He didn't think, like, people would be too receptive to his way of doing things. But eventually he came across a group of five of his friends, Dharma friends, who he'd been practicing with. And part of his journey was practicing austerities. So, you know, there were lots of, I don't know if people have been to India, but even today there were lots of wandering ascetics, you know, ash-covered, long-haired, naked dudes running around. And, you know, giving up, you know, possessions and giving up a sense of being engaged in the world and going through austerities. And Buddha, you know, practiced austerities like holding his breath meditation. And there's great descriptions of, like, Buddha holding his breath. This is like in his pre-enlightenment stage, right? So, his body got contorted and he's racked with pain, and still he was in this samadhi, you know, while he's not breathing, some kind of meditative state. But then when he started breathing again, things got back to normal. So this austerity practice was considered, one way to kind of let go of attachment to the world and sort of realize your true self, find your true self nugget. But Buddha kind of found that didn't work very well. The minute you sort of started breathing, life got back to normal. At some point, he ate a little food and sat down in a comfortable place. So this might be, some of you might feel like Buddha, you know, racked with pain when you're sitting on your cushions. And so, you know, after that experience, Buddha found a comfortable spot and found a way that he could sit until he could calm down enough to connect deeply with the world without obstruction. So I guess this is kind of a nice lesson to us. So austerities was one aspect of practice. And then another aspect is this kind of practice, or just our daily lives, of running after and grabbing and chasing and indulging in anything that kind of gives us sense pleasure. So those are kind of two extremes. So this is a little bit of a preamble of why Buddha might have been talking about these things. So this is the first the sutra, also known as Setting in Motion the Wheel of Dharma. So the person who's telling this story, Buddha's attendant Ananda, is the narrator and says, "Thus have I heard. Once the Blessed One, aka Buddha, was staying in the deer park at Isipatana near Varanasi. There he addressed the group of five, and he said thus, 'There are two extremes which should not be followed, friends, by someone who has gone forth into enlightenment.'" I would say by someone who cares for the world. "Devotion to pursuing sense pleasure, which is low, vulgar, worldly, ignoble, and produces no useful result. And the other extreme is devotion to self-denial, which is painful, ignoble, and produces no useful result. Avoiding these extremes, friends, the middle way that the Buddha is teaching to give vision and insight, knowledge, and leads to peace, profound understanding, and full realization." And what is the middle way that a Tathagata has awakened to, which gives vision and insight, knowledge, and leads to peace, profound understanding, full realization, and nirvana? It is the Eightfold Path, that is to say, right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right wisdom. This is the middle way that the Buddha has awakened to. So, very first paragraph, this middle way. Now, this middle way ends up being this Eightfold Path, right? So it's like, whoa. And my sense is that, you know, if Buddha showed up today, the Eightfold Path might be similar, but might have other aspects to it. The right way to interact with technology, or pay taxes, or something like that. So, since I guess taxes are due tomorrow. I want to say this is sort of like the first unfolding of the middle way. But the middle way unfolds throughout Buddha's teaching and throughout Buddhist history up until our present day. So this is one way to look at it, is this Eightfold Path. And it's kind of nice. You know, I think of this sort of like the 8-point plan, or, you know, like you take your car in and there's these checkpoints. So, you know, you can kind of check yourself. You know, am I upright in the way I'm seeing the world, in my intentionality, in my speech and action, in the way I make a living, in the way I put effort into my life, in the way I pay attention, in the way in which I'm manifesting meditation, and in wisdom, which is something else we'll talk about some other day. But, you know, so we want to maintain our Buddha vehicles, which are our bodies. And so Buddha was concerned with this piece of things. And I think it's nice to have some things like the Eightfold Path, which I don't want to go into detail in here. You'll figure that out. But there's ways that we kind of are sifting our actions and our experiences to kind of go, do we want to keep those, or how do we adjust these things to find a sense of uprightness? And at the end of that short little first talk that Buddha gave, people were quite happy, and the entire universe shook around and rejoiced, jumped up and down, and said, "Thanks, Buddha," which is often how these sutras end. And later on in his teaching, someone named Kachayana asked Buddha to speak a little bit more about this right view. And the middle way comes up more again, once again, in a little bit of a different flavor. So I'll just read you a paragraph of that. So, Buddha once again is giving a teaching. After that first talk, I guess it went so well, he just kept teaching until the end of his life for, I don't know, how many more years, maybe 50 years, something like that. So someone said, "Sir, people speak of right view. To what extent is there a right view?" So it's kind of cool, you know, and I encourage you to do this, you know, with teachers, with yourselves, with people in your life. People are always asking questions like, what is it? How does that work? So you're not weird if this stuff is not completely apparent. How to practice, how to be in the world, how to live your life. It's not quite a clear thing. That's actually our middle way. So asking those questions are kind of good. So, you know, the Buddha generously said, this world is inclined towards two views. Existence and non-existence. Sometimes people say a self that exists forever or a self that doesn't exist at all. Sometimes this is known as eternalism. Sometimes it's known, the other side is known as nihilism. But anyway, there's this sense that the world is generally inclined towards two views, leaning. Existence, non-existence. To one who perceives with right wisdom how the world comes to be, the notion of non-existence in the world does not occur. So you might say something like, you know, like kind of depressed, nihilism, who cares, nothing means anything, doesn't matter, why practice? To someone who kind of gets it, that idea, you know, it's a little bit of a goth idea, kind of punk idea, you know, sort of doesn't really occur. And it says, to one who perceives with right wisdom, the ceasing of the world, that is, that everything changes, everything disappears, the other side, of course, it also arises, the notion of existence in the world does not occur. The world, for the most part, Kachayana, is bound by approach, grasping, and inclination. And one who does not follow approach, grasping, and inclination. That determination of mind, that inclination and disposition, who does not cling or adhere to a view, this is myself, who thinks, the person who's kind of got it thinks, you know, stress in life, suffering that is subject to arising arises, and stress that is subject to ceasing ceases. That person does not doubt and is not perplexed. Here, one's knowledge is not other dependent. Thus far, Kachayana, there is right view. Everything exists, this is one extreme. Everything does not exist, this is another extreme. Kachayana, without approaching either extreme, the Tathagata teaches you a doctrine by the middle. And then he goes on to give another teaching that sort of comes across after the Eightfold Path, which is one that we're all actually very interdependent. So this basic idea is suffering arises from some idea that either I'm this little self-nugget, unique, bound by approach and grasping and inclination, that is addicted to trying to make the world the way I think it should be. It's another way to look at it. Or the other side of, I don't care about anything, doesn't matter. That the world is much more complex and wonderful than that. So that's sort of how the middle way got started in Buddhism. And I think that philosophically speaking, you know, that's kind of interesting and can be explored and was explored kind of endlessly in sort of the later schools of Buddhism. You know, for those philosophical types in here, there's a middle way school in Buddhist philosophy. Does anyone know what that is? Pop question.
Madhyamaka,
that's right. So that's one way of, it's sort of like physics, of taking your mind and really massaging it with a lot of counterintuitive ideas so that you become free of grasping to your ideas and see something about the way the world really is. But that's a whole other practice. I'd like to fast forward a little, skipping that Madhyamaka school, and say a little bit about the middle way as intimacy, as being able to actually interact with each other and be intimate and study very closely our temporal conditions, the world that we actually are part of and know right now. And in knowing that, we enter a state of curiosity and exploration and not knowing. This is also known as going beyond Buddha. So the middle way isn't just restricted to the Eightfold Path. And there's some old stories. So Taigen and Shohaku Okamura, who some of you know, have translated this kind of thick book. I need the soft cover version because this is getting kind of heavy, my old age. But this particular tome is a collection of talks that Dogen had with the people that he was practicing very intimately with. And for those of you who wonder who Dogen is, he's sort of the 13th century founder of our school of Zen, and lived in Japan in the mountains eventually with his community. And so, you know, unlike me giving this kind of long-winded, long talk, Dogen actually, in many Buddhists, gave kind of short talks where, you know, they'd just be kind of hanging out in the meditation hall and a talk would appear. And I think some of these talks illustrate the middle way kind of nicely, the feeling. And this comes about from interaction. So people actually kind of going, hey, you know, friend, I have a question for you. So here's a story. Taigen and Shohaku call this, what is intimacy? And it says, here's a story. Some Zen master once visited his teacher, and the teacher asked, Reverend, where are you going? what path are you on? And the student said, I will travel around. I'm going around on pilgrimage. And the teacher said, what is the meaning of pilgrimage? And the student answered, I don't know. It's pretty good. And the teacher said, not knowing is most intimate, is closest. Didn't say it's the only thing. Didn't say it's the right answer, but he said it's closest. And then the student was fully enlightened. So there's a commentary on this, which I think speaks to the practice in meditation of the middle way. So it says, in walking, in sitting, just hold to the moment before thought arises. Can you do that? Like in your sitting practice? Do you know what it's like to hold to the moment before thought arises? Study that. You know, and even if you don't think you know, you probably do. But that's one practice. So it says, just hold to the moment before thought arises, and then look into it. And you'll see not seeing. You'll see sort of this don't know mind. And then put it to one side. So again, there's always this experience of don't hold on to something. Go, aha, now I've got that moment before thought arises. So put it to a side. And when you direct your effort like this, rest does not interfere with meditation, and meditation does not interfere with rest. So this means that your whole life becomes meditation, your whole life becomes rest, and that you're not holding to either thing. And that rest is sometimes very important. I actually see lots of people who've been practicing for a really long time. They kind of look like they're resting in zazen, falling asleep a little bit. But I think they understand how to put something aside and not to cling. Dogen has some commentary on this. I completely leave the greatest intimacy to intimacy, which means sort of like, I don't try to make it something else. I'm just going to let it be what it is. But I ask, what is this intimacy? It is just all the Buddhas in the 10 directions and all ancestors, ancient and present, all manifesting right now. Do you see it? It is our present rolling up the curtain and letting down the curtain, or closing and opening the door to the meditation hall. Sitting down for zazen, getting up from zazen. Today, this mountain monk, which is Dogen, without begrudging my life or my eyebrows, for the sake of all of you, expounds this again and repeatedly. And he pounded the floor with his staff and got down and left. So kind of left people to their own business. So there's something about this middle way which is always inviting us to see the other side of things. You know, another image is, can you see the full moon in the crescent moon? Can you see your entire life in the crescent moon? Can you see right in the midst of your troubles, great joy and gratitude, without getting rid of your experience of what's happening for you right now? So our middle way is something that we only find through exploring our experience right now. So I know noticed when I was doing walking meditation that there were different temperatures on the floor. Did anybody notice that this morning? So I'm sort of like, I wonder if there's a pipe under there, if that was from somebody's warm feet, you know. But then it was colder in some other places. You know, it's like when you sit down on the couch and you feel like somebody's been here, or your dog's been there. You know, so there's something about that kind of feeling our way through life, that when we're slowed down enough to be intimate, this is our middle way. It's not trying to make it something else. And of course, you know, in some ways there's no middle way. There's just our way of living our lives. But it has this attitude of maybe not knowing that things, there's a little room to say that things might be actually a little bit different than they think they are. There's an image that I love very much that I'll share with you, which I've shared with you before, but I feel like it's kind of important. It's a painting by Hakuin of two monks crossing a bridge over a chasm. And this is the living of middle way. The living middle way. It's middle weighing. That it's not just some esoteric philosophy or some kind of abstract thing. It's your feet touching the ground with other people. So if you see in this image, there's this Lod Bridge, right? This is a very famous piece of work by Hakuin. And there's a verse that Hakuin wrote, caring for health and living life are like the blind men's round, long bridge. The heart that can cross over is the best guide. This is the heart of the middle way. It's the heart and mind of our practice. This is how we actually practice. So, you know, there's some carefulness to it. Zazen supports us seeing maybe where we get caught in confusion or caught in ideas of our own pleasure or getting away from things that aren't pleasure or trying to grab on to more money or trying to get rid of more money. You know, there's a whole bunch of things that we're trying to negotiate. Someone wrote to me recently, a practitioner, and said, you know, I'm always trying to improve myself. You know, well, that's good. You know that you're doing that. It's okay. Although there's nothing to improve, sometimes there's some need for improvement. Or Suzuki Roshi said once to the Zendo, you are all absolutely perfect. And you could use some improvement, you know. So this is that tapping, you know. So we're all helping each other tap. This is how we test whether we're on the path or not. When we can't hear that tapping, it probably means somebody's dropped off the side of the log bridge into the abyss of something. But, you know, we sort of nudge each other a little bit. Is that okay, Don? So we run into each other sometimes. We crash into each other, you know. It's like, whoops, okay. But this is our lives, you know. So this image of this tapping, you know, it's kind of a nice one to bring along, like when you get on the bus or drive your car. You know, we have this way of tapping with each other in cars, right? So this is sort of a way our life is. And it's an active, living, vital process. You know, there's this vital process of going beyond Buddha. So we can't follow Buddha's exact footsteps. Our feet are different sized. Maybe somebody has exactly the footprint of Buddha, although his feet, you know, were kind of shaped weirdly and had flowers on them and stuff. So I don't, you know, so his footprints don't quite match ours. But we find our way. And we do that only together. We only know by checking it out. And even then, we only tentatively have a sense. And I think it's very scary and kind of anxiety-provoking often to, you know, in our culture, we're supposed to know everything, right? Have it all figured out, you know? And like what the singularity is supposed to happen, where like, you know, technological knowledge and, you know, surpasses human knowledge. And, you know, it's like we're always knowing more and more and more, but we're always discovering. And I feel that that kind of discovery is pretty endless. And that's our life. There's a vitality to that. But when we turn away from it, it creates problems. We fall off the log bridge. You know, I think about, like, what does this middle way look like? It looks like this sometimes. There's a wonderful story of Suzuki Roshi, who is the founder of San Francisco Zen Center, and died in, you know, the 70s. But he's driving with one of his, a little Japanese guy, and his student is driving him, his disciple's driving. So imagine, like, you know, you're driving the big teacher, right, you know, back from some monastic place. And you stop, and they stop. They would always stop and have lunch. And along the way, this is, you know, the 60s, right? So, like, along the way, the student's, like, complaining and kind of, you know, puffing himself up a bit about his eating practices, you know. I don't eat meat. I know I can't imagine those people who eat meat. They go into a diner, and you know, Buddhists, what, they're supposed to, like, support all life, so you can't eat meat. So they go into a diner, they order food. Suzuki Roshi, you know, is sitting there. His disciple orders, like, a cheeseburger or something kind of veggie. Suzuki Roshi orders a hamburger. And they're sharing their lunch. Suzuki Roshi reaches over and said, "Here, why don't you, why don't we trade?" So this is this way of maybe helping his student. So he takes a big bite of the hamburger and is like, "Oh, very good. You know, very good. Our life is very good." And that's one way it can look, you know. I think being very intimate with your local conditions and not trying to make them, you know, if you watch certain teachers, they harmonize with the environment that they come into almost seamlessly. So they're not trying to, like, make us have the form of some other Zen center or, you know, imposing something, but there's a sense of harmonizing with the environment and studying what that is, you know. When I go to a new temple, I often will find the head of the meditation hall and just say, "What are the local customs about these kinds of things? Where I store my robes, or how we dress for certain events, or walk in certain ways around the Zendo?" But it's knowing your local conditions. It's sort of like, I like this growing our food locally kind of thing. You know, like, first it's like, how can we eat locally, you know? But, like, look, Native Americans lived in the Midwest with snow and everything else and seemed to survive. So you figure out how to harmonize with your ecosystem, with your temporal conditions, with your families, with your workplace. And sometimes harmonizing might mean, this doesn't work for me, I have to go someplace else. Sometimes it means, oh, okay, how can I see the full moon and the crescent moon? Children are, of course, are great teachers, right, in this middle way. You have some idea about how you want your children to turn out. Psychological research often says, has shown, actually, that parents have this whole vision of their child's life before they're even born. And any of you who've observed children might have noticed they don't always do. They don't always turn out exactly how you thought or do exactly what you want. But through your love, you learn how to harmonize with that and support it. So I think that this sense of adjusting constantly and finding a way to relax with fear of something that we don't know, and opening, you know, our hands to the world, that's just our middle way, and it becomes our ordinary life. It's really nothing very special. And yet this is going beyond Buddha. So... So my wish for you is just to keep going and finding and tapping together. Any responses on your practice of the middle way, or how, anything you'd like to talk about? reactions.
The Dogen comment, about the pilgrimage, that's always been something that sort of meant something to me, because once I had a teacher who said that, you know, life is a pilgrimage, and so when we're doing Zazen, we're really doing a pilgrimage. Mm-hmm. Your mind is kind of traveling and adjusting conditions and carry that off the mat onto your life and back on the mat, vice versa.
Mm-hmm. Yes. So that this isn't this, by the way, that little story, you probably know this, but it's not Dogen's story. It's from a collection of teaching stories that predate him. But Dogen liked to bring up these stories and then make his own commentaries, which is actually what Steve is doing. He's making his own commentary on, I think, it's a case 20 from Book of Serenity. Don't remember, but something like that. So, yeah, pilgrimage is important, right? This is, we're all on this journey, again, crossing that log bridge. But it's just our everyday life. It's not some pretty painting by Hakuin or some little teaching story. It's our reality, actually.
Could you share with us what case number or talk number it is?
Oh, in this Ehekuroku?
Yeah.
Let me look, see if I can find it still. Must be here. So this looks like it's Dharma Hall Discourse number 59. And the story about the interaction between the teacher and the student about pilgrimage is case 86 in the Book of Serenity, in case you're interested.
I was reminded of Rev Anderson's talk, Rev Anderson Roshi's talk last year. I think he was quoting a very similar story, and there was a further exchange with the student and Dogen, I think. The student asking something like, what is this intimacy?
Mm-hmm.
Responding, intimacy, intimacy.
Mm-hmm.
Which has really stuck with me.
Mm-hmm.
I love that word, and I love how Dogen emphasized it that way. There's nothing more to say, in a way, but to say it twice.
Yes. And this emphasis on intimacy, I think, is somewhat of a modern unfolding of the Dharma, that it's our current, we speak in a language that is the language of 21st century humans. And so I think this kind of closeness and intimacy is something very key and important for us, because we don't live together in the same way that people did many years ago, or people do in many countries that aren't quite as addicted to personal domains. So,
oh, go ahead.
Yep.
The two poles here between confusion and certainty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think my own reactivity, you know, I'm so certain about things, and I think it was something that I read maybe in Thich Nhat Hanh, to ask myself, am I sure? Which really helps move me away a little bit from that, when I can, to just ask myself, am I sure?
Yes.
About this opinion or reaction that I'm having.
So that's a teaching story, right? So a situation you might come up with in your life where you're like, oh, that's the way, and then you go, am I sure? So you're actually doing that own dialogue internally. But that's a great mantra, am I sure? It's a little Buddhist mantra. Thank you for that, yes. Like Suzuki Roshi says, not always so.
So, I feel like, you know, I fall off the log a lot, or I swerve, you know, but then that's how I learn, so I kind of almost have to do that. But that's when I come here, then I get the support. You know, I may not get that in other places, the way I get it here, or what I'm looking for. Do you know, like, it's not going to be quite the same here. And so then I started thinking about the elephants, because I kind of go that way. I was falling off the log, and so then I have my little elephant. And the elephants, you know, they all hang out, and they hook onto each other's tails. And that's how they support each other, you know, and they guide each other. I think that's the coolest thing, how they do that, you know, and we kind of do that here, and so, but sometimes, yeah, we bump up against each other.
Oops.
And I'm sure that, yeah, they're not okay. I think it's just really, really cool, and so I guess I appreciate maybe falling off or swerving as much as it hurts maybe when I do. But I appreciate that, your comment, am I sure? That's a good one. I like that. So. Thank you. Thanks for your talk.
Yeah. So in the middle of our swerving, being upright is the middle way. Yes, Joan?
I was thinking about intimacy, and that intimacy, I'm wondering if it's connection, just being open to my life as it is right now and not being caught in past and future. And I'm aware that I've moved enough in my life. Lots of people that I know now don't know me as I was, you know, 20, 30, 40, whatever, years ago. And so sometimes I think, well, they don't really know me. And then I'm thinking, maybe they do. Maybe they know me now. And that I'm getting stuck in me then. And so maybe intimacy is letting go of me then, because this is me now. Mm-hmm. And they know me better than I do in that sense.
Isn't that the case? You can run, but you can't hide.
Yeah.
Yes. There's a saying, nothing is hidden. We just think it is. And then you become close, like, oh, actually, I can learn something about myself from this other person who doesn't know me. Yes, sure.
About intimacy. I had like a little mini epiphany the other day riding my bike to school. I ride my bike sometimes when I'm preoccupied with my thoughts. Mm-hmm. And I was at a red light on the near west side, and a woman walked by. And I made eye contact and just gave her a genuine smile. Just being in the moment. And then she came up to me and she said, you know, that meant so much to me. I feel that no one ever smiles to one another in the city anymore. I just wanted to say thank you. And then she went on her way. And then the light turned green and I started paddling. And it's so funny, you know, those little moments of intimacy, just, I have no idea her life story or what she was going through at that moment, but it was really touching.
Mm-hmm. And somehow, you know, we often think we don't have enough time. You know, I'm racing somewhere, I'm kind of, you know, preoccupied with something, but then somehow, you know, whoop, you both could meet each other.
That 1 second in the city of a million people was really beautiful.
Yeah.
I noticed just recently, I've been noticing how hard people are looking. You know, it's, we're at the end of a long winter, so maybe that's part of it. But I ride the train a lot, so I've been noticing how everybody's looks like this. So sometimes I look like that. So I was like, oh, okay, well, I can just smile a little bit. You that would be a good practice today. Try to smile a little bit. And if then you feel like you're helping yourself, maybe someone else, at least to just counteract all that frowny face.
But if you smile, be prepared to interact. It's an invitation. You know, it's like, get away from me. But smile's like, oh, come on, say hello. And you're like, well, I didn't know. I didn't want that person saying hello to me. I only want this person.
That's right. My mom was in town, and she went for a walk, and she said, I didn't get one smile, and she's a smiler. She's a walker and a smiler, and she's the friendliest. And I'm like, well, sometimes then you're inviting. I said, most people I walk with their eyes down.
Yeah.
Because then you're inviting.
Yes. Good morning.
Good morning.
This whole idea of the middle way right now in my life, it really makes me think about, you know, intimate relationships, male, female, or male, female, but relationships. And it's always, I think that's like one of humanity's biggest challenges is like, you know, having some kind of connection with somebody, but not grasping, not rejecting, not feeling the need to, you know, control, possess. Know the future, control. So this is like huge. Everything on this page is like, you know, speaking to that for me is, you know, how do we have that experience of intimacy without anything else, you know, it by itself, without who cares what happens tomorrow, who cares what happened yesterday, you know, in the present. Very challenging.
It is challenging. And it's not that we don't have needs or that we're not ourselves, because it's also how do we completely be ourselves in the midst of that without clinging to some idea. It's a very, very, I think it's a very advanced practice, actually. And there's also the closer you get to someone, the more your tendencies that might be buried to try to control and grasp and shift and change and get what you want come up. So there's kind of this paradox, right? Like it might be easier to do with somebody on the bus, but with the person that you're sleeping next to or you're, you know, somebody you're really close to, your best friend, you start to get very intimate and these things come up. It's with practice. You know, the longer you practice and the more open you are and close, there's a lot of tension. There's always this kind of tension. And so that's one reason I think it's so important to practice in a Buddhist community, because you rub up against each other. There's also a Zen commentary that says, Master, why is it that intimacy feels like enmity? Hatred. It's supposed to be this lovely thing. Well, actually, it's very alive and unpredictable and intense. You know, the way in which we're connected to each other and to the entire universe is so, so intense. It kind of blows our minds, and we kind of short circuit. So we have to take, you know, little doses to get used to each other. It's very humbling. I will just say that in my own practice, to see one's own, my own habits and patterns around these things. But the only sort of the middle way is to just acknowledge, yes, this is what's happening, okay, and try to correct a little bit, you know. So right in the middle of conflict is the way out of conflict. Right in the middle of grasping is the way out of grasping. But I can talk about it, but actually living it is intense. I say, okay, help. I heard the Beatles song, Help Me, Help, this morning, and I was thinking, yeah, I need help. Help me if you can.